United. This is the third installment of our special lists, our lists of our top five personal favorite film directors. So far in the previous two installments, we've discussed, you know, everyone from Mike Lee to David Lynch to Spike Lee to Francis Ford Coppola, and we've got a lot more to come tonight in this final installment. We've already listed three each. And so now we're down to our final two each, and we're going to start with Jerry.
Okay, my first choice. All right, if you're talking about Peckinpah, then I have to bring up this other fellow, and that's Sergio Leone. You just have to. I mean, they're just part of the same, dynamic here. But it's another case like I watched Once Upon a Time in the West after, you know, watching all the Man with No Name movies for years. I finally watched Once Upon a Time in the West in my senior year in college in a film class. And I was just blown away by it, because I finally got to see it. It was important to see it on the big screen, I think, to really get the gist of it, not come in, you know, in parts watching it on TV or whatever. And I was just thunderstruck.
A big screen movie.
And I went back and watched an AFI, like, had a restored version of, like, almost 10 years ago, and then the restored version of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And just watching those on the big screen, and especially The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, seeing that great, the cemetery scene and all those wonderful sequences. But going back to Once Upon a Time in the West, that is, to me, like The Wild Bunch is like the other part of the equation. About it's very mythic, very epic.
Yeah.
And it's timeless, because I don't know if there really is a, because there's a great sequence where none of the clocks in the film have hands. There's a lot of potent symbolism in the movie, but there's a scene where the clock has no hands, and it almost, like, to me, signifies that there's no, this is like just, oh, it's almost like a dream, almost. But but I think the way the story unfolds, you have just Charles Bronson, what I think is his greatest role. I would have to say Harmonica is his best role, hands down. And it's this whole path, this elaborate path towards revenge. And it's just beautifully executed. Everything is really thought out in this movie. And what's interesting is, and then we have to go, you can't talk about Leone without, you have to talk about Morricone, because an essential part of all his movies is Ennio Morricone's soundtrack. And they would do the music before actually they would even start shooting anything. They would come up with the motifs and everything for each character and everything. And, oh, my God.
Well, yeah,
so
he played the music on set.
Yeah, and this was like one of the two, you know, Leone movies, that this and Once Upon a Time in America, that were butchered in their initial releases, and they were much more, they were better received over in Europe than they were here. And it took forever, you know, years before we get, you know, we still have another version of Once Upon a Time in America coming. And going back to the West, it's so involving, so engrossing, and it's a larger-than-life canvas. He's a fascinating figure, and I've read a lot of books about him, as with Peckinpah. I've read a lot of books, but all these guys that I've mentioned so far, and there are hundreds of them, I'll say, But it really, God, wouldn't you just love to be a fly on the wall during the making of these movies? I mean, just fascinating. Just, and we don't, I don't know, if, I mean, you still see it, obviously, today, and there are some movies, obviously, that definitely are you would want to definitely be part of, but these are just, like, seem otherworldly. And what I like about Leone is, yeah, he gets the bum rap that A Fistful of Dollars is a ripoff of Yojimbo, so much so that he got sued by Kurosawa. There's a lawsuit and everything. He thought he was getting a fan letter from Kurosawa, and then a guy in the studio had to explain, no, this guy suing you. This is a lawsuit. This is not a fan letter. Kurosawa is suing you.
I don't think that his reputation has been besmirched by that one iota.
No, his reputation has grown. So let me tell you a little story. When Robert Rodriguez was promoting El Mariachi, he was interviewed in the Post, and he openly admitted that, oh, I'm a huge fan of Sergio Leone. And the guy interviewing him was like, really? You own up to that? You like those films? Mm. And he is like, yeah. And I think it starts with these younger guys who were like were really influenced by him. I think Leone in the 90s got this huge resurgence. Not that he didn't have it. Let's be very honest. Among film buffs, we always loved him. Mm-hmm. I think. You see that. I mean, look, Peckinpah loved him. Peckinpah loved Sergio Leone. And Eastwood, obviously, Eastwood learned so much from him.
So let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
He had dreamt of making Once Upon a Time in America for many, many years before he finally got the opportunity to do so. But he was one of the first directors offered The Godfather.
That's right.
And he turned it down because he knew he wanted to do Once Upon a Time in America. What do you think his Godfather would have looked like?
Well, we know it had. Well, first of all, we know the who would be doing the music. That's one thing. I think his Godfather, it would be a very different movie. Even though it would be, it wouldn't be anything like Coppola's. Coppola's is a very unique. What Coppola brings to the Godfather was what. First of all, he didn't. You know, Puzo wrote a script where he made it all contemporary. Of the time, or that was one draft that was floating around. It took place in the 60s, and there are a lot of drugs and hippies and all that. And Coppola's like, no, this is not going to work. Let's do it. Let's stick to the book. But he did it in such a way that, it was just genius. I think Leone's version was obviously a very Italian movie. It would be very intricate. It would be longer than Coppola's. And I think it would be butchered in the editing process. Paramount would have taken it away from him. But his casting would have been interesting.
I personally think that if he had done The Godfather would be less footed in the real world. The Godfather is very much a movie that has its foot in the real world. And it would be a little bit more dreamy.
Coppola's Godfather? It's in the real world?
Well, I mean, I think that it's in the real world. Let's just say that it's in the real world in terms of how the movies see the real world. Let's put it that way.
Okay. But
what I'm saying is that it would be a slightly more, well, I mean, I just can't put it any better way than say that it's dreamy. I mean, if you look at all of his movies, we're not talking about Colossus of Rhodes here.
Thank you for bringing it up, though.
Almost none, maybe none of us have seen all the way through, you know. But you take, you know, his output, and really he had a small output from Fistful of Dollars on up to
the
final
true.
Film. If you take all of those movies, even Ducky Sucker, all of these movies take place in a world in which in a world that's been decimated, basically. They all take place in a desert, in a desert that's dry, that has no life left in it.
That's
I mean,
true.
In fact, when you go to a Fistful of Dollars, the first thing you learn about the town that Clint Eastwood is running through is that everybody dies here. You're either a killer or you're a dead man.
Right, yeah. And that's true in all three of those.
And then he goes on to prove that, you know. And, I mean, but that's kind of the case with almost all of his movies, with the exception of Once Upon a Time in America.
But
and
wouldn't you say that's the dreamiest? Couldn't you make the argument that whole movie is his, is a opium den hallucination?
Yeah.
Couldn't you make that?
It is. It is. It's completely, I mean, remember that incredible scene in that movie where the phone keeps on ringing for a long time?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that phone rings for at least 10 minutes.
You would think my dad was supposed to answer it because he never answers the phone now. So you
see, and you're going. When is this phone? And it creates this incredible tension.
Yeah.
That phone call is incredibly important.
Right.
Yes. I mean that movie is interestingly enough. That's the movie, you know, that feels most disconnected from time.
I'm not interested in your friends in high places, and I don't trust politicians.
No, if we listened to you, we'd still be rolling drunks for a living. Are you broke?
You'll carry that stink of the streets with you the rest of your life.
I like the stink of the streets. It makes me feel good. I like the smell of it. It opens up my lungs.
Arnon Milchan presents a Sergio Leone film starring Robert De Niro, Once Upon a Time in America. The story of friends. As boys, they made a pact to share their fortunes,
agreed,
their loves, and their lives.
You'll put up and you'll shut up. You hear nothing and you see nothing, just like you did for Bugsy.
You was better off just staying in the Bronx.
As men, they shared a dream.
I swear to God, Noodles, you and me together, we can make it come true.
To rise together from poverty to power.
There they are. Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
The problem is casualties of war, I think, owes something to Once Upon a Time in America, the way it's the structure, where the whole thing is he has this whole, Michael J. Fox's character has this whole thing is basically a flashback on a subway ride. And it that always reminded me of the whole opium den sequence of Once Upon a Time in America. The whole thing is this opium den, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, it has a similar feel to...
A compliment to Casualties of War. I meant that
it has a similar feel to a movie that we talked about last night, which is McCabe and Mrs. Miller,
which
also involves opium. But it plays almost like a hazy memory.
Mm-hmm.
It has the nostalgia kind of built into it. But he and Coppola had a similar sense of opera about them that The Godfather would share.
Yeah, but... Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. I agree with you there. But who really, forget Tarantino, Rodriguez, and even Coppola, you know who I think maybe had the biggest influence on Leo? Scorsese with Gangs of New York. Gangs of New York may be one of the greatest homages to Sergio Leone I've ever seen, down to the credit sequences. I mean, you talk about the end credits of Gangs of New York.
No.
Are right out of one of the Once Upon a Time in the West. And speaking of great credit sequences, the opening credits of Once Upon a Time in the West are fantastic.
Don't forget just that credit sequences, but also the incredible sort of animated credit sequences that are in the Fistful movies and
Good
and Bad and the Ugly.
No, the Good and Bad and the Ugly is great. The way each title comes on, you know, the good and then the bad and then the ugly.
That,
I love the way
that is something. That is something. You know, I remember seeing The Good and the Bad and the Ugly for the first time when I was probably 5 years old, and it was a regular, either first or second feature at the drive-ins that my parents took me to. And just going to see that movie, I remember being outside. I think I was outside of the car when I first saw my first frames of this movie. Mm-hmm. And it was the moment where, you know, it was those moments where, you know, the good and the bad and the ugly comes up in that red cursive script. With that music coming up, and of course back then, you know, there were at drive-ins there was not the radio sound that you hear now. If you go to one, it's piped through the radio. But back then, they had, you know, speakers that were piping the sound up into the ether. And you're not just talking about 100 speakers; you're talking about 1,000 speakers there, are piping this sound up into the air with that sort of crazy Doppler effect, where the sound is bouncing off the screen and bouncing back at the trees and creating this incredible sort of echo thing. That's just it's unreproducible and unforgettable. I'll never forget seeing that movie.
Here's some trivia about Sergio Leone. And by the way, I meant to mention this about Peckinpah. The last project that he was planning to direct, do you know what it was?
Now this is Leone, right? Or Peckinpah? Which one?
Peckinpah.
Peckinpah.
Oh God, no! What was his last?
He wanted to do an original screenplay by Stephen King as his last movie.
Never
came to be. It was called The Shotgunners. But here's some trivia about Leone. Leone was an early choice to direct Flash Gordon.
I could see that perfectly.
Yeah.
Definitely, because Dino De Laurentiis.
Yeah.
He was a huge fan of Gone with the Wind, and he wanted to remake
it. He loved that.
He talked about remaking
it. Oh, you can absolutely see that in his movies, too.
Yeah.
I mean, in so many aspects of his
He films, wanted to make a Civil War movie.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the two last projects was a Civil War movie with Richard Gere and Mickey Rourke called something with Mary in the title or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to make that, and he also wanted to make a movie on the Siege of Leningrad, which, bro,
yes.
I mean, I'm always sorry that we never got to see either one of these because they would have been fascinating.
Do you think, why do you think that he is somebody that showed, I mean, throughout the 60s up until the early 70s, showed so much promise, and you thought, okay, well, the next two, 3 decades are going to be filled with Sergio Leone movies, but they weren't.
No.
Why did that happen?
He produced a lot of things.
But
directing, I think it was hard to get movies made. I also think it's because of the experience of Once Upon a Time in the West, probably. Paramount did such a wonderful job of releasing that stateside. And I also think it just took a lot. And look what happened to Once Upon a Time in America when that first came out. That was not well received here. We're going to get to another director who has that problem as my last choice,
mm-hmm.
Because you were talking about the same kind of thing. Is it money or was it just self-doubt? That's a very good question. I don't know.
You're talking about what period of time when he wasn't as active?
The 70s, really, would be the 70s
well,
and the early
70s.
Those were periods of time where he was working to develop Once Upon a Time in America.
Yeah, that took a lot out.
You get the feeling, you're on board a project and you're trying to get it going and there's stall drawback after drawback, but you're always holding out hope. And, you know, he wasn't necessarily a director for hire. You know, he wasn't.
Yeah.
I think he had to feel close to something in order to commit to it.
Yeah.
And those projects, I guess, did not come to him. And he might have thought, you know, I can't commit to another project because this one might start going. And all of a sudden years pass, you know.
It's just a shame because, I mean, let's just take Scorsese for example. Scorsese would never let anything like that stand in his way. He would just go and barrel right on.
Well, because Scorsese from the very beginning, I mean, he started out making the Who's That Knocking on My Door and Mean Street's very personal visions, but then he went right into Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which was someone else's screenplay and a different kind of environment to which he had never explored before. I mean, so he was always open to different avenues and working with screenplays that weren't necessarily close to his personal experience. Mm-hmm. And he's a director. He develops his own projects. But people come to him with projects all the time, and he's of a mindset that, oh, okay, I'd like to explore that world and do that kind of movie. And
It's just a shame to me that somebody like Leone could lie fallow for an entire decade.
But look at someone like
really a decade and a half, you know.
Yeah.
No,
you know, I mean,
but look at Kubrick. He regretted not making more films.
Yes,
I mean,
of course. Exactly.
I'm sure Leone probably regretted not making more films as well, but I think he probably it wasn't in his constitution to just make anything that kind of came along, you know. And that's what made them so special. And Jerry, the directors that you mentioned, by and large, I mean, they've worked on, I mean, especially with Coppola and Sergio Leone. I mean, these are the two grand poobahs. I mean, they're kind of like titans of cinema. They work on broad, grandiose canvases.
Great. Sergio Leone never really got to. It's interesting because I also think he also had towards the end health issues too. We talked about this on the show.
He died at the age of 60.
Yeah. Yeah, 60. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, it was a heart attack, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about this once on the show many years ago, and it's a very important thing actually to bring up. Again, since we're talking about great directors we love, making films, directing films, at times seems like a very young person's field, just because it requires a lot of energy. A lot of energy, and as you get old enough, obviously there are some people who defy this, and more power to them. Woody Allen, Scorsese, Altman were all making films. Altman will work to the very end, and Scorsese and Woody Allen just don't seem like they're ever slowing down, which is good. But it does seem like when you're younger, you have more time to you have a lot more energy to make, to really go after things and everything. And I think Leone was beaten down by the system too, though.
Yes, I think that has
a lot to do with it. Look at someone like Orson Welles.
Exactly who I was thinking of.
Yeah.
And Orson Welles regretted even going into the film business. I mean, it was like, who would want to do this? It's torture.
I remember talking about that. It was a very interesting conversation we had a couple of years ago, because it does seem like, you know, as you get older, it's harder and harder, especially if you're having trouble, you know, if you're having trouble getting financing, which seems to be a huge problem, bigger problem today than ever, and distribution, that sort of thing. It does seem like it works against you, and if you have health problems, it's not conducive to your health to try to make
No, but, you know, it's he died at 60, which was far too young. I would have liked to have seen his King Lear, you know, the movie that you make with advanced age that only advanced age could allow you to make.
Right.
You know, and Kurosawa... Kurosawa made his King Lear with Ran, you know?
Yeah.
I'd like to see that. But I'm sure Once Upon a Time in America took a lot out of him. And at that stage in his career, when, you know, Sergio Leone is legend, you can't make as indelible a mark on cinema as he had at that time. Mm-hmm. Suffer a drawback and a betrayal like what happened on Once Upon a Time in America, it had to have been completely deflating.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it also possible too that he was maybe the right man at the wrong time, because he was somebody who was primarily known for westerns, and in the 70s the western was dying.
That's a big possibility.
And I also have to say this, and I don't mean this as a slam to Leone, who I love, but I feel like there's something about the spaghetti western that sort of put the nail in the coffin for the western in some ways, because because after the spaghetti western, after his spaghetti westerns in the 60s, it seemed like the traditional western seemed silly.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
there's some truth to that. There is a lot of truth.
You know that the western was inherently, I think he sort of made the western inherently sort of weird and dreamy. And then when you came back and tried to put, you know, Burt Lancaster and Valdez is coming or something like that, everybody said, "What? I'm not watching this. You know, this is ridiculous. This is not what a Western is supposed
but
to be."
But that's actually a good movie, though, based on a good book,
too.
Oh, I know,
but I mean, I know.
But you're right,
I mean,
it's
a good movie.
And it's interesting. Remember when Pale Rider and Silverado came out in the summer of 85, everyone was like, the Western's coming back, and no, it didn't come back. And it wasn't really until Unforgiven, really, that you saw...
Well, you saw a resurgence, but it still hasn't come back.
Yeah. You have a resurgence, but you do see, we have like things like, the you know, we have Westerns that are made overseas, though, is the big thing that's happened. The Proposition, or Sujeko Django Western, or things that, or smaller independent. We have seen some very interesting Westerns on a smaller scale, or even a bigger scale. Open Range, or Dance of the Wolves would certainly be considered Westerns. And
a revision. And you see reimaginings of Westerns. I mean, you see a lot of gangster movies that claim, but, you know, we're really Western.
Yeah, or like what's the
movies, you know.
Yeah, cop movies. But there's the one that with Billy Bob Thornton, South of Heaven, West of Hell, or something that came out at the turn of the century. Do you remember that with Dwight Yoakam, Billy Bob Thornton, and
very minor movie.
I'm just saying that so you have movies like that. You have these Westerns like that on the indie
the
scale.
The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Things of that nature. But, I mean, they always say, but I love it, like, oh, the Western's coming back. Yeah. No, it's not.
It's not ever coming back.
Justified is the closest.
They'll make a Western every once in a while, but it's never coming back like it was in the 50s, you know.
Deadwood would be, I guess, the best. Is a Deadwood to a lesser, and also Justified, even though it's not really a Western, but it's kind of a Western.
We've spent 30 minutes on Leone, so let's go to your next choice.
Okay, well, as you know, I really struggled with this list, and I tried to. I'm just gonna go forth and just say. A lot of the directors that we've picked are incredible personalities, and I think that it would be remiss of me, as much as I have other film directors that I really adore, because I am basically a humanistic person. I've said on the show before that I really like movies about people and character more than I do movies about plot. But that said, the next director that I'm going to pick is, well, it's all about people, but he's also all about plot, and that's Alfred Hitchcock. I can say, first of all, that when you think of a person in a director's chair, that person sitting in the director's chair is Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He is the epitomization of what it means to be a director. What does it mean to be a director? Well, it means that every frame that is put up on screen has your imprint on it. It has your imprint on it in the way that it's made, in the way that it's timed, in the way that it's spaced out, in the way that it's scored, in the way that the actors are put forth. But most primarily, particularly for Hitchcock, is in the way that the story unfolds. For Hitchcock, the movie was done after he had met with his screenwriters to work out every single detail of the plot. Down to what wine the characters were drinking. The shooting of the movie was an afterthought which is kind of extraordinary. Alfred Hitchcock famously never looked through the camera. He never looked through the lens of the camera. He didn't need to do that because he knew through the people that he had worked with, he had always kind of worked with, of course he had a 60-year-long career, so of course he couldn't work with the same people all throughout his career. I mean, this is a man that did great movies in the 20s, great silent movies, things like Murder and Blackmail, then into the 30s in the British film industry, just like in the 20s in the British film industry with things like The Lady Vanishes and The 39 Steps, then over into the 40s when he moves over to Hollywood and does Lifeboat, and Rebecca, Notorious, and Suspicion, Foreign Correspondent, and his favorite of all of his movies, Shadow of a Doubt. Then moving over into the 50s when you get things like Strangers on a Train or Stagefright, and then into his color movies, his brilliantly colored movies photographed by largely by Robert Burks, like To Catch a Thief, North by Northwest, Rear Window, even his black some of his black and white movies in that time period. One of my favorites, The Wrong Man, which is his only movie that has sort of a feeling of sort of a quasi-documentary. Then on into the 60s, where his output becomes a little bit more sparse, even though he achieves his greatest, probably the apex of his frame, his fame, with Psycho, which we should remember, Psycho is really an outgrowth of the thing that made him the most famous, which was not his movies. It was his television show that he did. He was a television personality. That's what made him the most famous film director. Just famous by sight. I mean, like, I guarantee you, if you took a picture right now of Steven Spielberg, theoretically the most famous film director on the earth right now, if you took a picture of Steven Spielberg to a small village in India, they would not know who that was. But if you took a picture of Alfred Hitchcock, even today, to that same small village, they would know who that guy is. You know why?
I'll try that tomorrow. But
I'm going tomorrow. Mine is cooking tonight. I'm going tomorrow.
Small village in India. What are you talking
about? What I'm saying is he is the most famous film director. He is.
I agree with you. I mean, he is known by black silhouette profile. I mean, that is the iconic Hitchcock image.
Yeah. I mean, he was a storyboardist. He storyboarded all of his movies. That famous Hitchcock, you know, that 13-line silhouette, that famous Hitchcock logo that we all know, well, that comes from him. That's the way he used to sign his autographs with that thing. So he has an incredible visual sense. He has an incredible sense of how to build a story, how to build suspense, how to build sort of an amity with his characters. And yes, he didn't always have the greatest. He might not have always had the greatest respect for his actors, whom he saw as tools. But at the same time, he knew how to get the best out of them, and they respected that. What I find fascinating about Hitchcock is that throughout his career, into the 60s and even into the 70s with things like Frenzy, I think basically if you know his movies, you know the man. You know what scared him. You know his faults, foibles, his desires, his tastes in the finer things in life, his taste in women, It's all of these things together. I mean, I'm not talking about specific movies here. I'm really talking specifically about the man and his movies together. This is why, for me, he deserves to be on the list. Even though I have other filmmakers that are slightly closer to my heart and sort of a, you know, just like, I would just love to be friends with these guys or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
We're actually, next week I record a show on Hitchcock because it's going to be part of our Halloween series. So I'm excited to have that conversation. But Tony Macklin's coming back, and that's what we're talking about.
Oh, cool.
Awesome. He's Hitch. But, I mean, here's a complaint about him, that he would plan his film so much that they felt a little too tightly controlled, almost like he made them, and then he made the movie, and then all that was left is he had to go out and shoot it.
Right.
But I think that he, for the large extent of his career, he worked in a genre that benefited from that kind of tight control. He knew suspense. He knew how to pull the strings. And he was just, as you said, one of the first and most indelible personalities. And yet his personality was part of the DNA of what people loved about his films. His personality did not overpower his films.
I don't know. I mean, you know, when you look at something like, you know, I'll go back to The Wrong Man. The Wrong Man is a great movie. And, you know, if you haven't seen The Wrong Man, which is a lesser-known film of his, it really shows, you know, he famously, got his sort of, I don't know, sort of his predilection for suspense and movies about, you know, law and order and so forth, and the breaking of law and order. Through a childhood experience he had, where his father, he had done something wrong. The young Hitchcock had done something that had displeased his father, and his father said, "Well, I'm gonna teach him a lesson, and I'm going to get my friend, the policeman, to come and get him and take him to jail, and he's gonna have to spend the night in jail." Well, this had a devastating effect on Hitchcock. It was something that, you know, obviously stayed with him. And when you take a look at something like The Wrong Man, and you see what Henry Fonda in that movie—he was an innocent man. He's a guy that's—it's based on a true story. He's a guy that's playing at the Stork Club in New York City, playing the bass in a band. And he gets picked up one night by the cops, and they say, come with me, and they take him on sort of a Kafka-esque journey into the jailhouse where they accuse him of a crime. And even though it's pretty obvious that he didn't do it, that he's a man on the up and up, there's a series of happenstances that occur that convince them that they've got the right man, and they put him in jail. That moment where that jail door slams on Henry Fonda and all you see is his eyes through that slot is the moment where you absolutely understand Alfred Hitchcock.
This is Alfred Hitchcock speaking. In the past, I have introduced you to many kinds of people. Murderers, thieves, swindlers, many of them geniuses at the business of crime. Now I'd like you to meet an entirely different person, an average sort of fellow, who leads a very normal life. The big difference is that his story is true. This is Manny Ballesterro, tucked away at the rear of the bandstand at the Stork Club in New York. He lived in a simple, routine world. When the lights went out, the fiddle was put away. Then, the same subway, the newspaper, home, to Rose and the kids. Yes, Manny's life was straight and narrow until the night of January the 14th, 1953, when...
Is your name Christopher Emanuel Bellicero?
Yes, it is.
I want to speak to you with police officers.
What about?
Just his sense of humor, sort of that sense of dry gallows humor that he had, which he displayed on the television show so much and in his hosting segments for these shows. Of course, he directed some of those episodes as well as Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which ran for 10 years. When you see him in interviews, you can still see interviews with him on YouTube. I did a story, sort of a commemorative story on Filmic Ability about Alfred Hitchcock on his birthday last year. And I included not clips from his movies, but just clips of him being interviewed for French television, from Dick Cavett and Tom Snyder, and the infamous
Tom Snyder.
Yeah.
Interview.
And
yeah.
Tom
Snyder actually makes a mistake of asking Hitchcock or telling Hitchcock, you know, many people don't think you're funny. Like, you don't have a sense of humor. You're like, really? I mean, that's, if you ever see any promotional trailer of Hitchcock or see him anywhere, I mean, his droll sense of humor is unmistakable.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it is funny. It is funny. I think he taught people. I think he changed cinema in so many ways. In that way of finding the funny in the dark, which, you know, we see in Lynch all of the time, or Psycho changed cinema in a very key way, in which very much like, you know, what Preminger and Saul Bass did back in the 50s. With sort of convincing people to arrive on time at the theater to see the full thing, Psycho really changed things because, you know, even the ad campaign for Psycho said no one will be admitted after the first 10 minutes of this movie. So, you know, you're not coming in and sitting through the rest of the movie and staying to see the beginning of it. You can't do that. And this changed.
Plus it was part and parcel with Hitchcock the Showman. I mean, and William Castle is like a similar figure in that way. He was a well-known filmmaker, but he was maybe even better known as a showman, how ingenious he was in the marketing of his movies. But, you know, we're about to reach a Hitchcock renaissance as well because, I mean, the box set comes out in a couple of weeks. 15 titles on Blu-ray, many for the first time. We have the HBO movie airing in October with Toby Jones, and then we have the Anthony Hopkins' Hitchcock movie coming out early next year. So we got Hitchcock in the bloodstream for a while now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and deservedly so. You know, deservedly so.
Yeah.
So yeah,
he's a cultural icon. I mean, two movies made about him within months of each other. It's and I just saw the trailer to that movie, The Girl, the feature.
I saw that too.
Yeah, the long version of the trailer. Toby Jones has the voice, right? It's going to be an interesting movie. And I'm going to try to get Tippi Hedren, actually, when that movie airs
That'd be a fascinating interview.
Yeah. I've never had anyone named Tippi on the show before. I mean,
and you never will again, I don't think.
unless Mrs. Gore starts to make movies, I don't think that. Oh, that's Tipper. I'm sorry. Yeah. All right, well, that's a perfect segue to my fourth choice, which is Brian De Palma.
That is the best segue.
It worked out well. Who's frequently compared to Hitchcock, it's kind of unflatteringly, is a Hitchcock clone. For me personally, I mean, yes, he's not made as many classic films as Hitchcock. He's not made as many films as Hitchcock, first of all. But for me personally, he takes what Hitchcock laid out and he takes it to the next level. I mean, there's everything is kind of more vivid for me in a De Palma movie. If you take the tightly controlled suspense sequences and you you know, it's like Hitchcock squared for me. If you take the perversity of Hitchcock, the sexuality, the how enamored he is with beautiful women, with dangerous women, with ulterior motives, with, you know, I just love, he's such a vivid visual stylist, first of all, and he's a great subversive political commentator as well. And a lot of times people miss out on that from De Palma. And I do think that his best movie is Blowout, because it's the perfect marriage of a suspense thriller, a 70s conspiracy theory style movie. I think it's the last of those 70s conspiracy thriller movies that really meant anything, even though it came out in 81. The joy of filmmaking, the process of matching sound and film is essential in that movie. And then you have the political subtext about an 80s America where the idealism is kind of dead. And that reflects in the lead character. And you know, his idealism is dead, and he wants to give himself another chance to make things right, and he fails. And there's a great sense of sadness when that movie ends.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of full circle when he's given up. That's what's sad about that movie, because Travolta has finally given up. He's given up the idea that an individual can make a difference against the big machine. And now, you know, those screams of horror are used for, you know, a terrible horror movie product, you know, a worthless little product. And I think that's what politically, like, especially when on the radical liberal side, as De Palma is, that's probably what the period of the 80s felt like, with Reaganism and big business. And so I think it was really a reflection of his times. And I think that most of his movies are reflections of their time. And I think that just like Hitchcock really carved a niche for himself in both the thriller and, on the other side of the coin, the grand adventure.
Right.
I think that De Palma's he's divided his reputation between his great work in the thriller genre and the gangster genre. I mean, you think Untouchables and Scarface, and regardless of what you think of either, you cannot ignore the fact that both of those films are landmarks of their genre from the past 30 years.
I mean, I have a confession to make about Scarface.
Yeah.
It's grown on me more than I ever thought. Maybe since we did that show where we interviewed the gentleman who wrote that book about Scarface.
Yeah.
I think Scarface, you know, you talk about the political, I think maybe Scarface may be the best movie about the greed and excess of the 80s.
Well, that's just
I
talked about Blowout being of its time, and a lot of his movies are of their time. But you also look at Scarface, and that is definitely a movie of its time. And there's another thing that is comparable to Hitchcock, in that we just discussed Hitchcock's sense of humor and how a lot of people miss out on that. I mean, there's great humor in Psycho that I think only decades later people finally caught on to. I feel the same way about most De Palma movies, but particularly Scarface. There's a lot of funny stuff in Scarface. But you're so kind of brutalized by it when you first see it that you miss it. And it takes several viewings to kind of see the behaviors in it that are just funny.
Well, I agree with you.
You know, when I first saw Scarface, I think I might have talked about this on the show. I went to go see that, you know, in the theater. I was very excited about it because I was a huge De Palma fan all through the 70s. Started with when I saw Sisters for the first time at the drive-in. I unabashedly loved Scarface that first time that I watched it. And then I went back to go see it the second time, and I was like, what the hell was I thinking? It was my first, it might have been my first, like, moment where I rethought what I had originally felt about a film, and I just said, what am I thinking? And I have to admit that still to this day, I still feel the same way about it. I find it a difficult movie to go back and take a look at, even though I do yet find humor in Pacino's performance particularly. I mean, it's very difficult for me not to watch that movie and sort of laugh at the, hey, look at the Batman, that scene.
You need people like me so you can point your fucking fingers. I say, that's the bad guy. So, what I make you? Good? You're not good. You just know how to hide. How to lie. Me, I don't have that problem. Me, I always tell the truth. Even when I lie. So say goodnight to the bad guy. Come on. The last time you're going to see a bad guy like this again, let me tell you.
It's a movie about excess, and everything in the movie is excessive. And so, I mean, it could easily be read as kind of a laughable thing. For me, the movie of his that diminishes in power and effectiveness the more I see it is The Untouchables. But then back to Blowout and actually in one his first feature, like one of his first features, which is Sisters. Sisters is really like the feminized version of Blowout, because with Blowout, Jennifer Salt character in Sisters. Her character is exactly like Travolta's character in Blowout, because you know, she's this ultra feminist. She stands for what she believes in. She speaks truth to power. By the end of it, she's essentially lobotomized. She's rendered impotent. Yet another kind of political statement, you know. And it's the same thing with Travolta and Blowout. I think he's still as vital and not afraid to shake things up as he's ever been, which I love about him. I can't wait to see his new thriller. And he makes Love It or Hate It movies. And he makes movies, and I'm reading it all over the place about Passion. People are saying about Passion, it's a really loony movie, but does De Palma know that it's a joke? I mean, is he playing it for a laugh, or is he playing it serious?
He's always doing that.
Yeah,
He's always doing that.
Yes, he's built
been
a
doing
career
that
off
for
of
ages.
That, but people are still asking those questions of De Palma movies. Like, they don't get what he does, they still don't get him.
Right.
You know?
No, they don't. But he still makes fascinating movies. Like, I like Femme Fatale. I think that was the last thing I saw by him that I really got into. But even something that doesn't work, like The Black Dahlia, I think has moments of genius in it and moments of lunacy that are just so exhilarating that I can't take my eyes off it.
Well, and he was interviewed about the remake of Carrie. And he said, you know, I spoke to Kimberly Pierce, and I've been around Kimberly Pierce in the past. And he says, you know, I think it's a fascinating project, and I think I'm so glad they're doing it. And he said, I saw that first image of Chloe Moretz covered in blood. And he said, that looked pretty damn good. I mean, he's excited. He's excited and supportive of the remake of Carrie.
Yeah, I think
and
it's a great thing.
Personally, I think that his most unduly criticized film is Mission to Mars, and I criticized it without even seeing it. I was like, "Oh, that's going to be incredibly lame," because I bought the press on it, you know. And then I watched it, and there's the majesty of just being in outer space. All the space movies, all the Mars movies, all of those movies. That's an element that's kind of missing. But you really feel it. I mean, you feel these people that are so excited to be on this mission and living in outer space. And there's this, and it's a Disney movie about evolution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a PG rated movie, which in itself is incredibly brave and radical.
And a great Ennio Morricone score too.
Yeah, and there's the haunting. There's one of those classic haunting, almost in a poetic way, scenes in Mission to Mars with the death of Tim Robbins.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Where she lets him go.
That's the moment that I remember most out of that movie.
Yeah, in mid-space, and he kind of disintegrates. Beautiful and horrific and poetic at the same time.
Yeah, when we did our tribute show to De Palma, I think I went out and bought all the ones I didn't have on DVD. I mean, I bought a lot of De Palma DVDs because I wanted to watch everything before we did our tribute show. And, I mean, even at his worst, he's still fascinating. There's just something about him that you just get fascinated. You get excited. I mean, let's be very honest. We're all excited that there's a new De Palma film coming out.
Yeah,
I mean, let's just be very...
Especially one in this genre, you know?
Yeah, I mean, but I mean... I do think Blowout is his masterpiece. I think Carrie's good. I like Dress to Kill. I mean, like I said, Scarface is, there's this weird resurgence with me with Scarface the last couple of years. I think Obsession, while a lot of people just say it's a ripoff of Vertigo, I love Obsession. I think it's
so much fun.
It's so much fun. It's so crazy.
One of his movies that's actually like extreme. I mean, you know, he gets criticized for being, you know, taking a lot from Hitchcock, but that's one of his Hitchcock sort of heavily Hitchcock inspired movies that actually comes in and actually kind of rivals. Like, hey, Hitchcock could have done this movie. He could have. It doesn't feel like a ripoff or anything. It feels like it does it completely. You know,
I love the Fury.
Yes. Well,
I wish there's a sequel to the Fury. I wish that he would make.
With the Fury, I mean, there's the Fury and there's Raising Cain. You look at those two movies and you think, this is a guy that's absolutely not afraid to be unhinged. I mean, those are lunatic movies.
But they're
alive in a way that few movies are. I mean, they make you stand at attention, and yet he's extremely adept at making the big budget Hollywood movies. I mean, Mission Impossible is a supremely well directed movie, and it's right up Brian De Palma's wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a perfect material for him to kind of explore.
Snake Eyes, like the opening, the tracking shot, the opening is a brilliant, brilliant De Palma sequence. I mean, there's a lot of great things, and even though, like, the lesser films, I think there's just so much to marvel and admire.
It's something that's been thrown against David Lynch, and some of us have thrown it against him, that Lynch is just, you know, he's aping himself at a certain point. He's doing his version. He's doing a very self-conscious Lynchian film. He's trying to out-Lynch himself. And I think that De Palma is actually brave enough to cop to that at times.
Right.
And quite openly ape himself. I mean, there's scenes in, well, first of all, The Fury. Any careerist would tell you that's not a great idea. You're doing another movie about telekinesis right after you did Carrie.
Yeah.
And then he does Raising Cain, and there's elements of Raising Cain where he returns to motifs and repeats exact scenes from his previous movies. I mean, people say that he copies Hitchcock. He self-consciously copies himself.
He tries
to raise the game on what he did before. You know, I mean, you think the Odessa Step sequence is that from Battleship Potemkin?
He redid a lot.
Which he kind of redid in The Untouchables. And then he went back and he redid it in Raising Cain in a different way, in a sequence that includes tons of references not only to Hitchcock but to his own prior movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like he's, and I said this to John Kenneth Muir during the show I did with him about De Palma, it's almost like he's saying, look, I did that in a movie. I did in this single sequence, he's saying, I did that in a movie and that in a movie. I did that thing in Dress to Kill and that thing in Carrie and that thing in The Untouchables. Aren't I worthy? Like he's saying, aren't I worthy? And actually, aren't I worthy of my kind of cinematic father who is Alfred Hitchcock? And actually, the movie Raising Cain is about a son that doesn't feel worthy of his genius scientist father.
Right.
So it's all tied into thematics with him, with the mm-hmm. themes of these movies. His style is directly collaborative with his themes. It's always motivated, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, always, yeah. I, you know, me personally, as I've said, you know, all throughout the 70s, I was, up for an entire decade, basically, I was a huge De Palma fan. But then somewhere in the 80s, around Body Double and so forth, I think it was Body Double where maybe even Scarface, actually, where my feelings began to change I still have very much affection for a lot that he's done, and particularly in the latter part of his career with Femme Fatale, which I really do feel is a return to form. Certain joys out of things like Raising Kane, which was a movie, by the way, when I first saw it, that I immediately got the humor in it. I mean, I think it's an extremely funny movie, and I think it's meant to be funny. But there's also a certain sense for me of, even though I can appreciate a lot of the craft that's in his movies, there's a little bit of a headache sense to me with some of his movies. And what I mean by that is that they're often, I mean, and I'm talking about this period that I don't care for, they can be confusing, or sometimes a little dull, and just sort of like, just a general sort of a dull throbbing going on in my head sometimes with his movies.
Mm-hmm.
That said, though, that first 10 years or so, and then we haven't even touched on his movies like Greetings or Hi Mom,
mm-hmm.
Which are definitely different films from what he's become known for. You know, that first period for him, you know, that excitement of things like Carrie and Blowout and Sisters. Those three movies in particular for me is like always, you know, when I think of De Palma, I will always think of those three movies, particularly Blowout, which still continues to amaze me. I could watch it again and again and again. One of the things about Blowout that I really, really adore is that I think it was, for me at least, with the exception of maybe Carrie, and the lead character of Carrie, it is the movie that I feel the most for his characters. I think that's what makes that movie great. Unlike a lot of his movies, I can't say that I feel a lot of compassion for a lot of the characters in a lot of his movies.
He's not necessarily asking you to. I think he's asking you to. I think he's asking you to feel compassion and carry and Blowout. And Casualties of War possibly with Michael J. Fox's character. But I don't think typically he's asking you to be empathetic with many of the characters in his films.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me to this quote I have that David Thompson wrote about him. And this actually draws a parallel not only between De Palma and Hitchcock, but also between De Palma and Kubrick. Because David Thompson wrote, there is a self-conscious cunning in Brian De Palma's work, ready to control everything except his own cruelty and indifference. And I like that. I mean, that I'm sure that was probably written as a criticism.
Uh-huh.
That could also be played off as a great plus in his work. I mean, one of the great distinguishing factors of his work.
This is interesting. As I'm getting older, the attraction of violence in movies is lessening. I find violence in movies to be increasingly repulsive, and I find myself wishing for just normal little movies about normal little people.
Yeah, but there are directors that want to make movies that involve violence, that if not say something about violence, which certainly Casualties of War, and for whatever its faults, Redacted, they certainly say something about violence. I think there's, I mean, look at Dario Argento. I mean, you cannot, and I put him in a De Palma class as well, you can't look at his scenes of violence and feel that they're at all copying the violence you see from other films. Mm-hmm. I mean, they find something in the violence that brings out the greatest thing about film. I mean, the very nature of film itself. There's an extreme expressionistic quality to it. And I don't think that it's geared to make you feel the violence. Like you said before, you know, you want to feel the pain of the violence. And it almost like it makes you see it in a very operatic, kind of perversely beautiful way, violence. And I think that's just a very unique way of seeing the world. I watch Brian De Palma movies because they're intoxicating to me. I don't see them to be as invested in character and uplifted by story as I do other films. You know, it's just a different, he's just in a different kind of class for me. Jerry, your last choice.
Okay, my last choice is David Lean.
Another grand scale director.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I just had to.
No.
I didn't want to change it. Now, I will tell you, I was flirting with John Borman and Paul Thomas Anderson, too, but you said five, and I didn't know how you could get seven in there. So those are two others, though, that were heavily considered. And actually, I don't know why Borman – I don't know how I dropped Borman out. I don't know what happened, but it just did. But no, David Lean. It would be really irresponsible not to put him on here, not just for Lawrence of Arabia, but also before Lawrence, I saw Bridge on the River Kwai in a theater, and that was really mesmerizing. But you know what? Of all of his films, the one I really go back to the most, or used to go back to a lot, is Dr. Zhivago. Mm-hmm. I love that movie. I love everything about that movie. I love all the Maurice Gerard music that goes along with all the movies that they did together. I went back after reading the Kevin Brownlow biography on him, and staying up late one night watching Ryan's Daughter. I didn't think it was as bad as everyone makes it out to be. I know I said that a couple of weeks ago on the show, but it's really not. It's actually a fascinating film to watch. And I think Passage to India is beautiful. It doesn't always work, but it's a beautiful film. But here's another guy. He didn't make a lot of movies towards the end. And there was a lot that he wanted to make. He wanted to make his own version of The Bounty, and he wanted to make Joseph Conrad's Nostromo into a movie, which they did make it into a masterpiece theater, if I'm not mistaken, in the 90s. But he wanted to make that with Brando at some point, and that never happened. And it's just a fascinating, and it's just larger than life films. But I have to say, seeing Lawrence of Arabia on the big screen in 1989 was the adult equivalent of the first time you see Star Wars in the theater.
El Orance. Truly, for some men, nothing is written unless they write it.
Not El Orance. Just Lawrence.
El Orance is better.
True.
Your father to just Mr. Lawrence.
My father is Sir Thomas Chapman.
Is that a lord?
A kind of lord.
Then when he dies, you too will be a lord.
No.
Ah. You have an elder brother.
No.
But then, I do not understand this. Your father's name is Chapman.
Ali. He didn't marry my mother. I'm sorry.
It seems to me that you are free to choose your own name then.
Epic storytelling and grand vision out there, that's like just unbelievable. It's just, wow, I didn't know you could do that. You could tell these stories, and they're amazing. And there are other directors. I mean, it's really interesting. Before these directors, like we saw John Huston's The Man Who Would Be King in the theater, or John Milius's The Wind and the Lion, Jerry, these are movies I grew up with, and I would walk up the street to see in the movie theaters in the 70s when we had a movie theater near here, and it was just these movies blew me away. But then you see where they all come from, and they all of them, all these, Emilius and Houston, you see they all come from Lawrence, really. Lawrence is the biggie. That was the one that when Angelica Houston always says that when they went to go see it, she said that their father said, we're going to see something we've never seen before. Some, this is going to be a night you're going to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And, and his movies are spellbinding. Even some, I like Summertime with Katharine Hepburn. I think that's such a different movie from him.
I was gonna mention that, you know, of course his career, you know, spans a lot further back than just, you know.
Oh yeah, Great Expectations.
Into the 40s and the 30s, but yeah, Great Expectations.
Brief Encounter.
A Brief Encounter, which is one of the great small movies of all time. Like that's just about, you know.
And he did Hobson's Choice, right? Hobson's Choice.
Choice. And also Oliver Twist. He did a great version of Oliver Twist.
Oliver Twist, yes. Oh,
and he was really a wide ranging sort of a humanistic kind of filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
But Bridge Over the River Kwai was the moment that was the film that sort of made him into just sort of a larger than life sort of filmmaker. Even though, you know, in reality he was really kind of a small sort of, you know, little gray headed man kind of.
Right. You're right.
And very proper and prim. But these movies, I mean, when you think about that guy taking I mean, when you think about the making of Lawrence of Arabia, taking that film crew out into that desert, having a film crew, this guy battled the elements like no other filmmaker has ever battled the elements, particularly
like with Ryan's daughter.
With Ryan's daughter, with the rainy Irish countryside, which bedeviled him throughout that entire production, and then you go to the snows of Russia, you know, for Dr. Zhivago. I mean, this guy towards the latter part of his career just said, okay, well, I'm just going to go out there and I'm going to conquer the earth. I'm going to make this thing. And I don't care what the earth tries to do to prevent me from doing it, but I'm going to...
Quite the antithesis of how the Pal Pressburger movies, which were all done on sound stages.
Right.
And everything. And that's what, and I love those movies, too. Black Narcissus, oh, my God, I love that movie. But it's just amazing. Just, you know, it's like we were talking about Coppola, you know, about the technological changes. And, you know, Coppola says, I really didn't mind, you know, I don't miss being out there. He prefers it, you know, the smaller films and doing it, you know, the technology and everything, digital technology and everything. And he goes, this is actually more my style than being out there in the swamp or whatever.
I mean, you could kind of make a case that David Lean actually sort of broke the movie's sort of addiction to being on sound stages and said, you know, if you really want to make your movie pop, you need to get out there in the real world.
And who really did that? Who really did that? Really to extremes is Werner Herzog with The Glory, Wrath of God and Fitzcarraldo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really going out.
You probably wouldn't have those two movies if you didn't have David Lean. I think David Lean showed Herzog the way.
Well, there's a lot of filmmakers that have been greatly inspired by Lean. I mean, Spielberg, chief.
Spielberg is a great is
the,
I mean
the chief of all of them. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know a lot about David Lean except this. I know that he wasn't very good at dating.
Hey,
because
well,
he got married six times. I mean, try dating.
That's good.
When you're out in the desert for 3 years, you think that marriage is going to last? Of course not.
Me and Johnny Carson, and Liz Taylor. But going back to you about Spielberg, I didn't put him on this list, but his influence, I mean, I think on our show and on our lives is, unavoidable. I mean, he's just someone. I'm very happy that I got to grow up in his, while his films were being, while he's alive and while his films remain, because they had a huge impact. I mean, let's be very honest, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Jaws, Close Encounters, those along with the Lucas, like the Star Wars film, those got me interested in the films and opened me up to what he was influenced by. And, Spielberg is, like we talked about many times, it's just a treasure. I mean, he's vital. I don't know how else to say it. And he grows as a filmmaker, too, I think. So.
Well, and Spielberg really, and I think Scorsese did, too. I mean, they were behind the revival of Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
And that kind of revitalized his presence. The following year, he got the AFI Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that was a resurgence in his career, brought on by the people that were inspired by him.
Yeah, because you had, and he was very ill, and he was going to make it. There was another movie, obviously, but he just didn't. He was very ill. He didn't get to make it, obviously. But because there's only what Passage to India and Ryan's Daughter. And there's a huge gap in between those films. And I think it was Ryan's Daughter he was crucified for.
Yeah,
that must have
taken the cash for that. And, like we were talking about Sergio Leone, I mean, I think that took a lot. That took the wind out of his sails, I think. So it's a shame he never got more.
Yeah,
I think you're absolutely right about that. And as we said, as we spoke about with Ryan's Daughter a few weeks ago, I still think that Ryan's Daughter is a tremendously misunderstood movie. I think one of the reasons that Ryan's Daughter is misunderstood is because the first, up until that point with Kwai and Arabia and Chicago, those three movies so perfectly meld together.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling of the epic storytelling along with sort of a political sort of statement. And unfortunately, there is a political element in Ryan's Daughter, but it comes a little too late in the movie to make an
mm-hmm.
impact.
Right.
It starts coming in like about 30 minutes after the intermission, and it feels a little tacked on. And I think, when we think of Ryan's Daughter, those of us who love it, it's not that element of the movie that resonates
right.
like that element resonates in those other three movies. It's the element of the small movie.
Mm-hmm.
He was so famous for early in his career with things like Brief Encounter. It's that element of the small movie that's writ large.
Right.
That actually impacts those who do like Ryan's Daughter. And that is sort of a cult movie, I would say. I would consider that like one of his few like cult movies. Like,
right. Mm-hmm.
It's only a small amount of people who really love that movie, I think.
Right.
But it's out there.
Right.
And then, we can't forget, Passage to India, which was, I think, still a wonderful movie. It's not a movie that a lot of people go back to, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't. It's
great performances. A lot of great performances in it.
It is, and it's a very mysterious story. And if you watch it, it asks you. It does not tell you what to think. It asks you to make your own mind up what happened
mm-hmm.
in those caves and so forth. So it takes kind of a chancy leap for for David Lean. He took a sort of a chancy lead for that movie. I mean, not something that he wasn't unfamiliar with something like
you couldn't make that today.
You
couldn't do that with Al Guinness today. Though. There's no way you could have, you know, a British actor play an Indian. It's the first thing I think of when you, because that, even at the time that came out, that's 84, 85, that was even then considered like almost unnecessary. You could have got, you know, you could have gotten an Indian actor to play the part. There was some a little bit of controversy with that, but I won't lie. Alec Guinness is wonderful in it.
But I don't know why that needed to be. And I do know what you're talking about there, and that was controversial. But I think that was misguided because just a couple of years earlier, there was a British man who won for playing Gandhi.
Exactly. Not even a couple of years. Only like two years ago. Like two years, I think, before that.
I think people were mad at that. There was a certain amount of people who were mad at that movie for not being Gandhi. But that was.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, I mean.
It wasn't Gandhi.
It's a different story, dude.
To make Gandhi, but he didn't. So.
Okay. Half hour left. Dean, what is your last choice?
My last choice, well, it just has to be.
First of all, tell me how difficult the process was, too.
Well, I'm still grappling with it. I have five filmographies right in front of me, and I'm looking at it, and it's just, I don't know. I'd just be betraying myself if I didn't say that it was Stanley Kubrick. It's just, it would be a betrayal. And
okay, you know what? We're in luck because Stanley Kubrick was my fifth director, too, so we can double up.
Yes.
Time saver. That's great.
I thought.
God, I feel like a loser. I should have picked Kubrick. I could have picked Kubrick's input a lot of time.
Well, you know, unlike you, Jamie, if I understand you correctly, that you've come to love Kubrick later on in your life. Relatively recently, that Kubrick, the appeal of Kubrick was something that eluded you.
Yeah,
but that's not the case with me. When I was 11 years old, the lady that taught me how to read, she actually said I already knew how to read. She just was there feeding me the stuff that needed to be read. But I always say that she's the lady that not only taught me how to read books, but taught me how to read movies. She took me to see a movie that I had always wanted to see. And I remember my parents being in the back seat and driving home from something that we saw at the drive-in. And my parents being in the front seat and talking about this movie. So you remember that movie? Of course, they said the title of the movie, and they say, oh, it had a baby at the end of it. And then what the hell was going on in that movie? I just don't know. I still don't get that movie. And they were just so frustrated about this film. And I remember being in the back seat saying, I got to see this movie. Of course, that movie is 2001, and this is the movie that
I love that. I knew what you were talking about when you said baby.
Of course, the movie is 2001, and Jane took me to it. I saw it on the big screen for the first time. And it felt like, even though I was always a movie lover, since I was a little baby, my first memories are being at the theater. But even though I was always a movie lover, it felt like I had never seen a movie ever before.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like some veil had been lifted. I felt, you know, interestingly enough, I felt that I got that movie from the moment I saw it. And when I went back and researched it later on, primarily through that book that Jerome Agel came out with called Making of Kubrick's 2001, which I only saw as a paperback book that was always in the used bookstores. You know, you could always find a copy of that book. I must have gone through 10, 15 copies of that book in my lifetime because they just fall apart. I just look at them so much. But I remember picking that book up after watching it. And it has a, that book has an incredibly cogent analysis of 2001 in it that was sent to Kubrick and approved by Kubrick. It was sent to him by a 17-year-old New York high school student named Margaret Stackhouse. And she actually broke 2001 down into sort of a three-act kind of, I don't know, mathematical equation of some sort. And I read this and I was like, yes, I got this. I knew it. I knew it. Why is everybody so confused by this movie? I just don't get it. Why are people confused? And of course, I read the book and it had letters to Kubrick from people that said, oh, why did you make this movie? And then it would have other letters that said, you inspired me to look beyond the stars. And then a letter, a cable from Federico Fellini that said it was the most incredible thing you'd ever seen. And just this divisive sort of back and forth about this film. Yes, it was a confusing film, I guess, for some people, but it also spoke to a lot of people to the point where it was a huge moneymaker. And it wasn't just a huge moneymaker, as some people like to say, because it was released during the era of the hippies and people were dropping acid. There's not that much acid in the world, okay? not everybody was going to see 2001 who loved it was dropping acid and smoking a doobie before they went in. That was just some sort of way to dismiss it. That movie is unlike anything. There's nothing like it. There never will be anything like it. There will never be anything made that's anywhere remotely as good. There's not another movie ever that will be made that is as ambitious, that dares to tell the story of the entire course of humanity from ape to superhuman. 2001 aside, then I was a huge fan of 2001 at 11. It didn't take me long to find Dr. Strangelove on television. Dr. Strangelove was one of the funniest, but yet creepiest, weirdest sort of amalgamations of emotions that I've ever had, particularly watching it on television. I think it works very well on television because it's framed in that way, you know. But that just sort of, that sense of sort of, well, I mean, there are a lot of moments in that movie that almost feel like a documentary. All of the scenes in the B-52 with Slim Pickens. A lot of the scenes that take place outside of the Burleson Air Force Base with Sellers and Sterling Hayden, all of those scenes that take place outside of that Air Force Base when they're trying to shoot up the Air Force Base trying to get to General Ripper.
General Ripper. Oh, God.
You look at those scenes now. And they're obviously, you know, as in many of Kubrick's movies, Kubrick was a master photographer who had worked as a 17-year-old New Yorker, had worked for Look magazine, and had been an accomplished still photographer for quite a number of years before he even picked up a movie camera, like in the late 50s, or mid-50s. But you look at those scenes where he's filming almost like sort of newsreely kind of war footage outside of that Air Force base. You see so much of something like, you know, Saving Private Ryan, you know, in those sequences.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they're referenced a little bit in another Kubrick movie, Full Metal Jacket. Okay, so then there's that. Later on, it only took me a little while to discover Paths of Glory. And again, Paths of Glory, which I still consider to be my second favorite Kubrick movie. Paths of Glory, when you put in Paths of Glory now, it's a 90-minute movie. But it has such narrative drive that I swear, it really feels like it's like 10 minutes long. It never fails to amaze me. I just watched it again just a few weeks ago, and I was just like, it just never dies. How great that movie is! It just snaps on by, and it just gut punches you with just and so simply just the absurd folly of wartime morals. Okay, Paths of Glory aside, Clockwork Orange. Then you get into another morality play. A morality play that's about what is it to be human? What is it to be truly good? Are you still truly good if you're forced to be good? Isn't it really the choice between good and evil that makes us human? And if we have the choice to make people good through technology, should we take that choice? That's what that movie is all about. It's not about the joy of violence and all that stuff. That's what it's about. It's a basically Christian message. Very surprising coming from somebody who has been characterized as being nihilistic. Barry Lyndon. A beautiful, beautiful movie about a complete naive kind of dunce. You know, he's kind of just sort of blown away through the ashes of history, even to the point where at the end of the movie, all it's the placard that comes up on the screen that says, good or bad, all of these people are in the same place now. They're all in the grave. And it doesn't matter who they are, because it's all about the ephemeral quality of history and the ephemeral quality of just about everything that we do, no matter how important we think it is at the time. It's about it's all going to go away. Then The Shining, which was incredibly drubbed when it came out. Now it made the top 250 movies of all time in the BFI list that was just released a few weeks ago. Why? Because it's incredibly emotional. You can feel that he put everybody in that movie through the ringer. He did it on purpose. That was his way of creating horror. Now, I don't want to get into all the different things that Room 237 and this show has gone to about you know, the different readings and so forth like that. Even if you don't read anything into it, the movie is still effective as a straight horror movie with incredibly weird, creepy elements to it, things that are unexplained. And the unexplained is obviously the most horrific thing that we can think of. That's what makes that movie great. It has dread written all over it. Okay. Full Metal Jacket. A movie that I know that Jamie has a hard time with. But Full Metal Jacket is another film that basically shows, you know, what's interesting about Full Metal Jacket is it's basically one of the only movies out there that's a two-act movie. It's not a three-act movie. It's a two-act movie. And it basically has no ending. They go off into that field singing the Mickey Mouse theme, and then it just keeps going on and on. War is not something that's ever going to be eradicated. That's what that movie is all about. It's not ever going to be eradicated. It's something that men love. They do it because they love it. It is about the essential killer nature of man. And that's its raison d'etre. Finally, Eyes Wide Shut. I saw Eyes Wide Shut, of course, like we all did, months after Kubrick had died, and I went to a preview screening of it, and I knew that this was the last time I was ever going to go see a Kubrick movie. And this movie was, I just feel, you know, I feel like, you know, Eyes Wide Shut might be the one movie of his that's actually influenced by another filmmaker, which would be a sort of a David Lynch influence. And I know that, that Kubrick was a huge fan of David Lynch, particularly of Eraserhead. And I feel like Eyes Wide Shut is not only a movie that's obviously a movie about marriage and trust and what it takes to keep a good marriage going, and the level of communication that's needed. And we have to remember that Eyes Wide Shut was a movie that he struggled with for years. I mean, he was talking about doing Eyes Wide Shut since the 70s. And he brought it to his wife, and his wife, whom he had been married to at the end, by the end, he'd been married to her for 45 years or whatever. He brought it to her, and she said, "I just don't know. I just don't know about this movie." And the reason they didn't know about it was because it was a movie about marriage, and it was a movie that probably engendered some fights between them, you know. And I bet he found that interesting. I bet he found it interesting that this is a movie, this is the idea, this is a movie idea that he had brought to his wife, whom he obviously loved, and it created maybe some sense of rancor between them a little bit, you know. And that might have been something that he kept into his he kept in his mind. He might have found that fascinating. He was obviously you know, a loving husband, and you know, even though he's married three times in his career or in his life, but you know, the last one really took. Obviously, he was obviously a loving father, and yes, you know, he was. I don't think that he was a recluse. He just didn't need to leave because the world came to him. You know, Eyes Wide Shut is interesting for all of those, for all of these reasons. You know, this the sort of playing with dreams, the recognition always that we're watching a movie, and that the watching of movies is like dreaming. And you can't always be sure of what is real and what is not. You know, when you wake up from a dream, sometimes you don't know whether what you've been. I mean, I've woken up from dreams and thought, yeah, I really can fly. I can fly. I do it all the time. You know, and then I remember, no, I can't fly. You know, that's what that movie is all about. That movie is all about, you know, the sort of interplay between dreams and what dreams actually reveal to us about ourselves. It's not just about marriage. It's about dreams, and it's also about the act of watching movies. Eyes Wide Shut. You know, finally, I just want to say this. There will never be another film director ever in the history of movies that has the kind of influence, the kind of power, the kind of just exacting eye to the point where it was ridiculous. I mean, we've seen, hopefully you guys have seen that documentary, Stanley Kubrick's Boxes, which is about his huge, you know, collection of files of about mm-hmm. all of his movies that he collected over the years, thousands and thousands of boxes on his estate in Borehamwood in England. I mean, he actually had, you know, photographers for Eyes Wide Shut go and photograph almost every single square inch of London, you know, to the point where they, where the photographer actually was said he had to go out and photograph every single building on this street. But Kubrick didn't want the photograph to be taken from the ground. He wanted it to be taken from the air. So this photographer actually had to go out, and the photographer was actually his nephew, I think. This photographer had to actually go out with a 12-foot ladder and then climb up the ladder, take the photograph of the building, then go down 10 more steps, climb up the ladder, take a photograph of the next building, and then tape it all together. And then when Kubrick finally saw the whole thing taped together, this look of this entire street, just hearing a 60-foot photograph, panoramic photograph, taped together for him, he said, boy, it's sure a lot better than going there, isn't it? And that's, I mean, the guy just, nobody is ever going to be able to do what he did, ever. That's why it'd be remiss for him, for me not to put him number one on this list.
Well, I mean, I've kind of talked myself to death on Kubrick, but I could not put him on my list either. I will say a couple of things, one of which came to mind today. Because a lot of times when you talk about the aspects that make a director great, you talk about he knows exactly what he wants. You hear actors say that a lot, like what makes a great director, somebody that knows exactly what they want. I've never gotten the sense that Kubrick actually did. He worked in a very different way. He worked in a kind of way where I know what I want when I see it. Surprise me. When I see something that's surprising, I'll know that that's the moment. That's the magical moment. That's the big reason why he spent so long making movies. He was constantly searching for that moment. And I think it's a mistake to think that there is an absolute reading on some of his films. And honestly, he didn't actually tell the Margaret girl that she got it right.
No, he said it was a very cogent reading.
Yeah, because he actually has a quote that says, the second you tell somebody what your movie's about, it ceases to be about anything.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I
agree with
that.
Yeah.
That's the enduring power of his work. And it's not just The Shining. It's most of his films are critically derided at the time of their release. And as the years went by, they were appreciated in a greater way because he makes the kinds of movies that constantly reveal different layers to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the definition of movies that live. And in a way that the other directors can't compare. I mean, they don't have the level of ambiguity, the strange kind of, it's a strange tone in his films because at first you view them as kind of detached, but then as you get deeper and deeper into them, you start to feel them. And I start to realize, well, they're not so detached. It's just a different way of approaching a film, because usually for me, when I view a film, the way I get into it, the first way I get into it is from an emotional standpoint. And for me, the way I got into Kubrick films was not first and foremost emotional. It was kind of an intellectual process. And as soon as I got the think of it, I got the feel of it.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's the opposite way around for me with
filmmakers.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, I mean, he's a giant. And there's ongoing explorations of what his films mean to new generations that grow up with his movies. And what fascinates me aren't the wild theories about him as a person or the wild theories about the content of his films. It's more about, there's very few directors that you can explore in this way, because his movies don't dictate anything really to you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to find yourself in them. You have to kind of navigate your way through them. And I think that if you don't like Kubrick, I mean, I didn't respond to him just because I didn't respond to that general tone. And generally, with any director, I don't respond to that tone. But I wanted to say, what am I missing with Kubrick? I didn't give him I didn't give him a fair shake. So then that's when I embarked on this thing, and I watched all of his stuff, and I was receptive to them. I think that the majority of people that aren't receptive to him are just lazy moviegoers. After a certain point, you know, they're not used to bringing themselves to a movie. They just let this movie happen to me. But
yep.
I mean, he's director that every single movie, I mean, Barry Lyndon was dead dull. You know, it was like upon its first release, oh, this movie's so dull. It's like Kubrick doesn't know how to tell a story with any pulse whatsoever. The years went by and people caught on, oh, it's not just a beautiful looking movie. There is a beating heart in this thing. And I think it's also something that he shares with Hitchcock and De Palma. There's a cool irony at work. He's a very ironic filmmaker. And I think that turns some people off, and that goes over some people's heads as well. But I wanted to ask one question about something that you said, Dean, about Clockwork Orange. And that was something you said about it kind of reflecting Christian values, ultimately. Where do you see that?
Well, in the fact that if a man is not given a choice, if a man is not given the choice to be good or evil, but has one of those choices foisted upon him, does that, and in this particular case, the choice is foisted upon Alex that he be good through the Ludovico treatment.
Right.
Are you not taking away his essential rights as a man to choose those two? You know, if you are a Christian, you must realize that you have a choice always to be either good or bad. Now, I'm not to say this with just Christian things, but this comes up in the movie through the character of the prison pastor, who counsels Alex and says, you know, Alex says, I really want to be good. And he says, well, to only be good, you must just be good. That is it. But it is your choice. You know, this choice is taken away from Alex.
Right.
And this is what he becomes, as in the title, The Clockwork Orange. He becomes a, yes, he's still an organic being, but he's a machine now. And machines are just programmed, you know. And then we get back to HAL and so forth with 2001. You know, Hal goes through the same thing. He's programmed to be the way he is. He's, you know, I mean, this is a theme that goes through a lot of his movies, you know. Even Barry Lyndon and, to some extent, The Shining and even, you know, Full Metal Jacket, where those men are made into killing machines. They're no longer able to choose whether they're good or not. You know, this is a basically Christian message. You know, I'm not some guy that's trying to out here convert you to Christianity or anything like that. I'm not some kind of
I know that. I mean, but Kubrick, Kubrick and Christian have never really gone together for me. I mean,
yeah, don't you think that he's being in A Clockwork Orange though? Don't you think he's being sardonic by saying, oh, if you want to be good, you just have to be good.
That's a gray area, too, because I honestly I honestly think that Kubrick believed we're all good and bad. I mean, we all have both of these sides within us. It's called human nature.
Yeah.
And yes, we have a choice of which side we want to represent. But and I saw him explore those themes, and that's the problem I have with Full Metal Jacket, is that Full Metal Jacket finally for me felt like a retreading of themes that didn't live up to his prior explorations of those themes. And he did return to certain motifs time and time again, but he returned to them and explored them in a different way. I mean, The Shining has a lot of stuff that he explored before, but in a very different context.
Yeah, true.
But the movie that feels most mysterious to me now is Eyes Wide Shut. And because it's a, I mean, obviously it's about marriage in one sense of the word. There's a dream logic to it. There's this male-female dynamic in the movie that's very fascinating to me. And how Tom Cruise is very, second time tonight I've used this word, very impotent in the movie. And the female kind of has such a tremendous amount of power. He also loved women. And I don't know necessarily that aspect of his life really pops up that often.
No, it doesn't. You're right.
Even though I do feel tremendous empathy with Wendy, but in The Shining, but Shelley Duvall was cast essentially, I'm sure, not only because she's a capable actress, but because she looks like someone that would, just by looking at her, that would be completely subservient to Jack.
Mm-hmm.
That would not be necessarily her own woman. But I do feel an evolution in that movie where she does finally have to take initiative in that film and find the strength.
She finally has to realize she's...
Yeah, she finds the strength
somebody.
She didn't know that she had, yeah.
Yeah, she's with somebody that she suspected for a long time has had some serious problems, but here they are to the fore, and now she's got to do something about it.
Yeah.
I like just a sort of a straight on look at The Shining, and you know, I mean, I'm fascinated by all the theories and everything, but I just like to look at it straight ahead as what I feel that it is. Eyes Wide Shut is incredibly mysterious, and I still think to this day, I think it's going to be a little while before people catch up to it.
Me too. I think that movement's starting to happen. I don't love Kubrick movies because there's always different theories surrounding them. I don't believe a moon landing thing, but I do believe, you know, the Holocaust could have possibly been subtext in The Shining, and in no way does that diminish my appreciation of the movie, and I don't understand people who feel threatened by it, like it somehow diminishes their appreciation of the movie. Because people are violent about it.
It doesn't. Oh, I know you got some. You said you got hate mail for that episode of that show. Did you not?
A lot of it, yeah. And I'm like, chill out.
I don't know why people would send hate mail over to anybody about any kind of whether it be The Dark Knight or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that's a movie is worth sending hate mail to anybody. You could spend your time sending hate mail to people who really deserve it, I suppose.
Yeah.